please.
Yeah, thank you, Siegfried, for the nice introduction. I'm really happy to be here to discuss with you some aspects on self-propelled colloids. I think that is really the topic of this self-propelled micro-object workshop now. Here is a picture of Düsseldorf University, and this is, I mean, some important building of the city. Our city is the capital of North Rhine-Westphalia and has about, say, 500,000 inhabitants and a university. And there's physics there, in particular soft matter physics, also with my colleague, experimental colleague Stefan Egelhaf, and my other colleague Jürgen Horbach. We have a soft matter group there. Okay, self-propelled particles, let me start with this introduction. If you go to the very southern part of our globe, you find these nice animals. They don't want to move now, but they it is the most so.
There is the soundtrack.
I could try to get it.
I think there is quite some noise.
Okay, so this is the reference. And so lots is going on in these hurdles of penguins, and these are emperor penguins, and they are here, of course, active, since they are moving on their own, and they are collecting at very high densities. So you find 27 penguins per square meter. So these are these penguins of this size, so there's quite a lot going on. And you also see something like a crystal here, if you are very optimistic, and some kind of nucleation and solvation or melting of these crystallites. So this is the motivation to go with methods of statistical physics, very simple models to describe this non-equilibrium behavior. And we know that active particles really occur in very many different situations. They are characterized by dissipation of energy and are intrinsically non-equilibrium and very different from passive particles, which are driven by the external fields. So while passive particles are, say, getting a kick in the neck and moving due to an external force, these penguins and also these other particles move on their own. They have their internal motor. And my goal is to discuss simple models for single and also collective properties of these active particles. I will mainly talk about colloids and also bacteria.
How do you model the evolution of life?
Well, that's a good question.
You
should model different sexes, yeah, males and females, and so attractions and all this. Yeah.
So, how I can tell them apart. And then you also want to keep warm?
Yes, that's the reason why they cluster. Yeah. And they are two-dimensional, so two-dimensional models are well realized. Okay. And
the stacking has not yet been.
The stacking has not yet been.
No,
stacking in different layers.
In the third direction.
If these guys could fly. And okay, I will tell you another story about starlets if there is time. So this. Two dimensional semantics. So here's another example. Passive particles like this woods. Pieces of woods following the streamlines of the river, and here a school of fish which is moving on themselves. You all know this. Now we go to the micro world of soft matter, where we have a micrometer scale. So we are talking about micro swimmers, and this means that in typical solvent we are at very low Reynolds numbers, and here are different examples of bacteria, E. coli, sperm, and also this Bacillus subtilis. Let me focus a little bit on these suspensions of Bacillus subtilis. These are suspensions which can be also prepared to be two-dimensional. And then can be watched on a microscope. And what you here see is an almost particle-resolved picture of the collective motion of these guys. And you see that this is very complicated and we have to discuss this. Here, these bacillus are more or less, say, Like the penguins are more or less a sphere, this bacteria are more or less a rod, aspect ratio of 5 or 7, something like that. And they're moving along the long axis by themselves. But there's also the old idea of passive colloidal particles. We have spent a lot of time in exploring the physics of these plastic balls in external fields like shear electric or magnetic fields. There was also a German-Dutch network on that, which has now come to an end. So this is the past and this is the future. And you know that there are these catalytically driven microswimmers like this nanometric Janus particles, which are then driven by an H2O2 decomposition. We're moving in this direction, and the good news is that you have not a complicated stuff like a penguin, but a rather simple stuff like a particle, but it is internally driven by this catalytical drive, so it's moving in this direction, then it also has an orientation which is subject to fluctuations and interactions, and so there's something like a moving object. There are other ideas, and let me put forward this idea by Clemens Bechinger. We work with him, and he's in Stuttgart and does also Janus particles, so Janus spheres in this context. And the idea of Clemens, I think it is a very ingenious idea to control the motion a little bit better than in these systems, is to put them in a water lutidine mixture. So the solvent is not just water, but water lutidine. Water lutidine has an upper, a lower critical point at about room temperature, so 33 degrees. And if you heat the system from, say, the one phase region A into the two phase region B, it will spontaneously separate into a lutidine poor and a lutidine rich region. So there will be, upon heating by a laser source of this metallic cap, there will be spontaneous demixing here, and this gives rise to a process that puts the particle into motion. And the good news is, well, here you have some kind of fuel, like the H2O concentration. You can here do everything by hand. For example, you can program protocols where you turn light on, off, the particle moves, stops, and you can change also the parameter very, say, flexibly. So this is a colloidal, an active colloidal particle under control. It is in an external field, yes, but it has its internal motion. And I think that these particles have very high potential for future explorations. My feeling, by the way, this is parenthesis, is that 70 or 80% of the swimmer business is in theory and simulation and only few experiments. And we certainly need more experiments, and we need more experiments on colloids, since then the models are simpler than the real bacteria. We need both. So here's a need, and I think Clemens Bechinger fills this gap. Okay, now let me come to the to one possible model. It's a model, I confess, which ignores hydrodynamic interactions. I think this is a sin in this meeting, but we'll do the sin, okay? Since there are reasons that you could maybe neglect it for high concentrations, they average out. But let us neglect them. But put focus on the particles itself. We model anisotropy explicitly. It's a particle resolved modeling, so every particle is discretely modeled, and then we have an aspect ratio here. We have an interaction here which is almost steric. It's made soft Yukawa-like for actual computer simulations, but the details shouldn't matter. And we implemented it as a segment-segment repulsion between different segments. And then you sum up over the segments and you have the total potential energy. And more importantly, you have an orientation vector U alpha or U beta for particle number alpha and beta. That's along the rod direction. And that governs the direction of motion. So the rods will move in this direction. There's no, well, there is a pointer here. So we have rods which move in this direction. So they are not, they are polar, since they have polarity due to their direction of drive.
So these rods are perfectly rigid?
Yes, they're not flexible.
Spheres within a rod.
Flexibility is a very interesting topic. We have also done studies on that for spheres or deformable spheres, but then you couple more degrees of freedom into the dynamics. So I stick to rigid particles. So now comes the second sin, which is not a sin actually. But it's how to model the internal drive. The internal drive we model simply by a formal force. It's in this overdamped, so we have overdamped equations of motion. It's Brownian dynamics since we are at almost zero Reynolds number. So it's friction times velocity is force. And this force is coming from the interactions between the rods. And now we have an internal force or an internal drive that is this force which acts along the orientation. No, we had big fights in the literature that this is not a real force. Of course, if
swimmer is force.
The swimmer has no external forces, but nevertheless, it is put into motion. And you can, I think also Golestanian has shown it in a paper, you can describe it formally as if it would be a force. And it is maybe better to call it propulsion velocity, but formally it is a force, and so it's an effective force. The swimmer is force-free, but it is moving nevertheless. And that's the place where the self-propulsion enters into the theory. So this is not Hamiltonian, so you cannot derive it as a gradient of a potential, clearly. So this is a non-Hamiltonian system, and therefore it's also a non-equilibrium system. Here are the friction tensors for rods. I mean, they are known from De La Torre and others, so you can feed that in. This is not important. So we have no hydrodynamics.
It is important in that you are, this is as close as you come to putting hydrodynamics
in the problem. In the sense on the one-body level, yes. But there are no hydrodynamic interactions between particles. There is no noise, but one can include noise. That is no problem at all. But problem is that in non-equilibrium, one is not completely sure that it is real temperature. It's maybe also an effective temperature anyway. And we have two spatial dimensions. No problem. You can generalize it to three, but then we have...
Yeah. Oh, so you don't even have any rotational
noise? No, we have rotation. Rotation.
Oh, rotational noise.
Yes.
You have no noise at all, not even
depending on the problem I will talk about.
The limit of zero rotational noise, I mean, certainly for disks or soft disks, can be rather similar.
Yeah, so if it comes to soft disks, I will include rotational noise, but then it's, say, a little bit upgraded, the model. Yeah.
Because you stress somehow this driving force. I think it makes a difference, right? You need just a effective velocity here. Because
your friction tensor is anisotropic. So that means when you convert this
internal drive to a swimming velocity, your
internal
drive is actually always parallel to the internal axis.
Then you have to renormalize in the worst case the tensor. But OK, we have done many studies since we were attacked by Feldhoff. So you can. Yeah, but you can,
so
you can work with the same tensors in very good approximation. For example, if you take a Golestanian swimmer which drives a rod, then you can prove that it is the same tensor. But in general, you cannot prove. So then, I come to this point later. Let's take experimental data and measure it. Measure the tensor. There must be a tensor since we are in linear response theory. And if you don't know it, you can measure it. But it is a point, yes.
This FT is a uniaxial tensor. And then you basically take this FT, the inverse of it. So you convert your internal drive to a velocity. Then this velocity is not directed along your U, which I know.
No, but here it's a uniaxial tensor, and the propagation velocity and the anisotropic E are on the same. In the same direction, so there is no problem.
Right.
But there is a problem for arbitrary bodies.
So
it is a deep problem, but okay, for this simple, this is a simple, say, zero base model, and then you can upgrade on that. And so we have a length unit, that's the range of the Yukawa interaction. We have a time unit that expressed in some times in the external drive. We have an energy unit, and we have an interaction potential over internal drive, which is some kind of, is it Peclet number anyway, a ratio, which is fixed in the following. But we vary the aspect ratio, so the physical size of the particles and the density, which is aerial fraction or volume fraction or number density in some scaled, say, length scale. So we change concentration and aspect ratio, but keep the drive constant. So first, the single particle limit. So this is now just one rod, and it is moving along orientation. And if you can solve the equations of motion easily, since there is no interaction, so this is zero, and you integrate up and get, say, a ballistic motion with constant speed. That's what Holger said. So you get the propagation speed from this tensor. Here it is. So we have this formal effective force over the tensor, which is the propagation velocity. And this is just a constant, say, a trivial uniform motion in one direction. Now, what Christina asked is more noise. You can put noise on top of it for translation and rotation. Then the solution is more complicated.
I don't know
the exact probability distribution in two and three dimensions with noise, but one can calculate for the displacement statistics, for example, what one can calculate analytically any moments. The first moment, the second moment, and even the third and fourth moment, and so on. You can calculate that analytically, and then you can discuss when this swimmer is Brownian, so it has a diffusion constant or the non-Gaussianity. Normally, it's diffusive for very, very small times. Then it's getting ballistic for not so small times, and at very long times, it's again Brownian. It's a long-time diffusion coefficient, which is normally enhanced. So it's like, you know, due to the propagation. And in between, there's a regime where it's not Gaussian and you can calculate that. And
I guess that my concern was mostly with the rotational notion. More rotational noise. Because, so a long time you just said there's a diffusion coefficient which is enhanced. And the enhancement, I believe, is even for typical separable law, it's like two orders of magnitude larger than the thermal diffusion coefficient.
Yes.
So there will be no problem. So negative translational noise, I think, it's no problem. But the rotational noise, I think, sometimes can.
And the rotational noise, in fact, sets the time scale upon which it is ballistic.
That's right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, inverse rotational sets this time, and that increases.
When you have zero, you have it ballistic at all times. And in some systems, I think that can be some
So that's one of the most important parameters which limits the ballistic motion and then gives rise to a very large, long-time diffusion coefficient.
Is that limit of ballistic motion just how long the case limitation
can be used by pi? Yeah. And I don't have a slide, but I have slides for the fourth moment of this distribution function in simple models, and then you get analytical results. Anyway, but what is a bit, say, also more important, it has been not so much considered in the literature are torques.
So if you have rotation
in your business, you can also include not only an internal torque force, but also an internal torque. So why not including plus M here, where M is a torque, an external torque, or internal. In two dimensions, it's the same, which means that the rod in any time step is also rotated. If M is positive, it's anticlockwise. If it's negative, it's clockwise.
So that would require that your particle
be chiral.
Be
chiral? Chiral, yes. Or the particles can be a sphere, but
the propulsion mechanism is
anisotropic. Yeah, there are many, many reasons. Something inside which gives you a systematic drift. And I will come to examples. Yeah. So this is the first example. There's no chiral.
Yeah,
is it chiral?
In two dimensions, is chiral. I know you put it over here.
So this is a particle which performs a circular motion. So it's a pedestrian, it's a Japanese pedestrian. This is a strange paper since it's a Japanese scientist publishing in the Journal of Korean Physical Society. This journal exists. I saw it. I had it in my hands. Anyway,
so they took 21 students,
they were numbered and then blinded and earplugged, and they had to go for 2 hours over the sandy beach or over the meadows, and this is the result.
Yeah, so it's really
stepped a little bit biased in one direction. It's not a perfect circle. If there is some Brownian noise, I think this is a realization of a circle swimmer, which is Brownian, so there is exactly this stochastic torque turn.
Is there a correlation between the 20-degree turn and the antithesis?
Oh, you can ask very interesting question. I have no idea. Maybe I ask him. Yeah.
maybe a correlation between which side of the vertigo.
Which side of country you were in.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
To the extent the US was the other way.
So these are here more serious particles. So these are now really these chiral particles we were talking about. They are lying on a substrate, so they are in two dimensions. And they have this L shape, like the capital L. And it can be chiral or anti-chiral, depending on which direction this small leg is pointing. Yeah? The idea is the same. So these are, say, prepared. And then there is a little gold film here, which makes it a Janus L particle. And then it's a group of Clemens Bechinger again. You put laser light onto it, and then there is this diffusion zone, the local demixing, and this puts the L into motion. And since it is so chiral, it's so an ideal realization of a circle swimmer. And there is noise, of course, in it, so it is a Brownian circle swimmer. And here is a movie, an experimental movie, which shows that they're almost moving on perfect circles. And Borge ten Hagen and Felix Kümmel, they have explored this. I mean, 6 years ago, we did some calculation just with the simplest model of a Brownian circle swimmers. And then you could calculate the moments of the displacement function. For example, even the first moment is not trivial. So the first moment means just you average over the noise, you start. Then you go, but then it's getting more fuzzy if the nose is acting. And you get for the first moment an analytical result, which is a logarithmic spiral. If you have only small damping, it's a spiral which has many turns. Strictly speaking, it has infinitely many turns until it comes to an end here. And that is the first moment. Since, on average, you don't move.
Sorry, when you say the first moment, you just mean the average position.
So this was in the literature, and then we checked with Clemens about the experimental facts, and here you see the difference between experiments and theory. We also checked that these ratios are in a constant, the ratio is constant if you move from the outer into the inner circles. That's characteristic for a spira mirabilis. So in this sense, this is the average. In this sense, this prediction is confirmed, so we have very nice realizations of circle swimmers. And there's lots going on now. We have put that into gravitational fields by tilting the sample, but I will not talk about this since this is a single swimmer.
Sorry, what about the second moment? Does that eventually become diffusive in the third
one? Yes. Yeah. So, and you can calculate the long time diffusion constant, and it can be done analytically also. It's in this paper.
So eventually, if you've been discovering for a long time, even at low noise, you won't see this beautiful spiral, you'll just see
some motion. Yeah. Yeah. And the diffusion constant is small, since you don't move, more or less. No? Okay, and Rafael Witkowski, who is now working with Michael Cates in Edinburgh, he is interested in difficult problems, so I gave him the problem in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, you have, of course, it's the classical spinning top problem, the classical spinning top, which is treated, for example, in the book by Felix Klein and Arnold Sommerfeld. So it's classical mechanics, but if you go to Brownian motion, it's not so much done. Yeah? So I am now talking about an arbitrary shaped body that is not symmetric at all. So we have, the moments of inertia for the molecular dynamics. Now you have a hydrodynamic friction tensor for the Brownian dynamics. And then you have to be also careful to go to write down Langevin equations, since there's a problem with Ito and Stratonovich and all this. So it's not trivial. But some work has been done by Doi and De La Torre. And I think we worked that out and also included now a constant force, a constant torque in the body frame, so constant in the body frame, which makes it a swimmer. And then you can calculate also some things, not everything, but in the simplest case of orthotropic particles, so where the tensors are more or less diagonal, the logarithmic spiral gets a Concho spiral. A Concho spiral is from the snail house, something which goes also in the third dimension. Yes, I refer to this paper. So there's really, I think, also experiments are needed to go into third dimension and to see that. And David Pine has ideas for that. I mean, we worked with David Pine, NYU. We worked on passive particles, so they glue spheres together like little dolls. And then you can test the Brownian motion, say, in a three-dimensional rotational space, which is complicated and is okay. But now if you would make them active, you get this much more complicated particle motion. So what I would like to point out is, even a single particle is a very complicated problem. And then if you expose it to flow fields like Holger did, it's more complicated. And if you have interactions and hydrodynamics, even more complicated. So let us come to the many-body case now. So for this rods I talked about earlier. So here is a collision event. So now you have two rods, self-propelled rods, which go in this direction. They come together and then, okay, they align more or less. And it's completely different from momentum conservation, where you have elastic kicks. Here it's inelastic since it's overdamped. They get along and then this angle, scattering angle, is getting smaller than before, so there is a tendency of mutual alignment. And this is similar to the Witczek model, but it's more microscopic reasons. It's really model the individual particle motion, that particles go where their neighbors go. This is enforced, or this comes out here as a matter of collisions. So it is expected that this model exhibits some swarming, that we have swarms, and then we are in this business.
With your
rods, with your microparticles, or? That's a good question. I'm also confused. What I'm doing now is working with rods with this particle model at finite concentration. So our ground zero model.
So your interaction that is still the Yukawa potential, yeah, that you had. So I mean, I'm not sure why you call this like a Witczek model.
It's not a Witczek model.
It's a particle collision, particle dynamics.
It's the Witczek model is much more coarse-grained, but it's similar in the sense that if you have particles in the neighborhood, they align somehow.
Should be in same universality class.
I don't know, but it's the same tendency, let's say.
It has been shown that self-propelled rods are not in the same universality class as the Witczek model.
So can one define the notion of a universality class?
Well, I mean, it has been shown that self-propelled rods ultimately are in the dynamic states, not in states with polar rods.
It never would impose it.
In the large system, really, if you define the three new systems.
So we are non-equilibrium, so in universality classes is not trivial.
Okay, that's something that was shown by us, and then
I would
by
be happy to know what it means.
I mean, Gerhard did some simulations that confirmed we showed this in 2008, and Gerhard did some simulations that showed this.
In no range of parameter space?
I think not. I don't think he has explored the entire range of parameters.
Anyway,
yeah, I mean,
if you go to this model, you get much more interesting and fascinating behavior as compared to the Witczek model. Yeah? So, which you don't get in the Witczek model. That is the topic of my talk.
You get a very rich behavior and even polar clusters, I would call them, and so on. But if you ask about the long range order, it's always thematic.
Or the long range order, yeah.
It's never polar. It's intrinsically different from the Witczek model.
Since both of you use the notion of a universality class, I really would be curious to know how it is defined.
Well, I don't
know. Well, that goes not beyond the topic.
So unfortunately, this is not the topic of my talk. Well, it's interesting. Question of divergence of correlation length in the phases. What are the exponents? Maybe, I don't know. What Rick Wensing did is say explore this parameter space of density and aspect ratio. So you prepare your rods, you let them run, you add some initial noise, but then you get into a steady state. There's no noise in this model than for the steady state. And then you can classify the states, with order parameters in this state diagram. These are not real thermodynamic phase transitions, but just say tendencies.
And you have the dilute phase
here at low densities, that's for sure. And a little bit of problem here is we have low density, but also zero temperature, so there is some interaction from the Yukawa tail. But anyway, let's call it dilute phase. At very high density, there is a crystal here. If you have spheres, very high density, it should be a crystal. Or if you have, say, close to it, it's a jammed phase. Let's call it jammed phase, where nothing is moving. And there is disorder. There is a swarming phase here, where you have big swarms, which are due to the mutual alignment of the neighbors. And this has also these high density fluctuations. That is for intermediate densities, but high aspect ratios. Here is laning. So here with high densities, particles align, but they are not polar, as you said, but they are on average, not polar, and they are moving along lanes. So these particles are moving upwards. There is another bunch of particles moving downwards, and this is then the steady state of this situation. Here we have intermediate regions where much is going on. And there is a special other region here, which we delineated from this region, although this is not a strict distinction, which we call turbulent. And I will focus on this turbulent phase in the following. So real bacteria have aspect ratios that are in this range, and also densities which can be achieved, say, considerable volume fractions. So they are in this domain. And I claim that here some kind of turbulence is going on. This is another thing to call it turbulence. Let's say a swirling state, some rotation. And let us look into it now in more detail. Here you see some snapshots. So these are real experiments in two dimensions. So these are confined suspensions of Bacillus subtilis, dilute phase. This is the turbulent phase, so you see swirls here, and this is the swarming phase. Now, the turbulent phase can be characterized by some kind of swirls. So if you look into this direction, you see some tendency to turn around, but there's other points, it's the other orientation, so on average, there's no global rotation. But locally, there is rotation, and you can characterize this by defining a coarse-grained velocity field. That's a vector field at any time, coarse-grain in space. And then you calculate the vorticity of it, so the curl of this field. And this is not zero. It tells you that some rotation is going on. And this is called, in the turbulence literature, the so-called entropy. Not the entropy, but the entropy. Here I sketch another, say, continuum model that was invented by Sebastian Heidenreich and Jörn Dunkel in this paper. You start from incompressibility condition, Navier-Stokes equation, where you put the self-propulsion in by this friction term. So the particle, this friction is zero if this is zero, so which means that the particle wants to go with this speed v. And then you put in the rate of strain tensor, not only just, say, the normal viscosity, but you make this negative, make the next term stabilizing, and then you get some kind of, say, basic model for this kind of turbulence. It has swirling with a typical size in it that's governed by these ratios. It has self-propulsion in it as governing by these two parameters. And this is the pneumatic tensor that's from the active pneumatics. And if you solve this, you can also check whether you find.
If I remember correctly, this model, the runoff is assumed to be negative.
Negative.
And so this is negative.
If you
and
have any,
so negative is positive.
Where did I come from? I mean,
no, it's on this scale, it's phenomenological. What is the minimal model to get this kind of turbulence? And this is some kind of. So next strain, leading order.
Right? Because if you think of V as a velocity, then it's a negative viscosity. If you think of V as an order parameter, then it's a negative stiffness.
Yes.
So
it's a rather strange, but it's an active fluid, so maybe the question is, can you model it, or what do you need? And you can never get it easily with a real viscosity, since I have no idea. But here you get it. But I do not have a microscopic expression for this. Gamma not via correlation functions, that would be interesting.
There have been several microscopic derivations of this kind of equation, and nobody has come up with something that would make a lot of negatives.
I don't know.
Nice to have some suggestions.
I know some people are working on it, but...
certainly physically, your collision mechanism would make you think that would be possible.
Yes.
Because it tends to want. I suppose it's possible for people to know that theory is uncaptured by any one.
Yeah, but it also describes the simulations, which are not bacteria, but simple self-propelled. Anyway, so you get at least, you get in the experiments, in the self-propelled rod model, and in this continuum theory, which is admittedly phenomenological, you get the same kind of structure. This is a vorticity map, where you plot the curl omega of the velocity field. If this is dark blue, it's clockwise. If it's dark red, it's anticlockwise. And you see that on the scale of the system size, there are several swirls. So there's a typical swirl size here, that is this length scale. But there's also considerable vorticity. If you would do this plot for another phase, there's almost no vorticity. Then the question is, I don't go into the details now, but is it related to real turbulence? So we can check the spectrum, the energy spectrum. Does it follow any power law, at least in the regime between the particle scale and the swirl size? Yeah. And then you can check for the energy spectrum in this region, and you don't see consistency with Kolmogorov-Kreisnahan scaling, which would give in two dimensions a K2 minus 5 over 3. Here you get another exponent, and the question is it really an exponent or is it a crossover? I think this is some kind of different turbulence than the turbulence at high Reynolds number. So self-sustained turbulence or...
Do you think mediated turbulence?
I don't think so. What is defect mediated?
So it looks like you have topological defects in this thing, and the number of defects fluctuates.
So you mean here, this is a defect. The defect with a topological charge, that's what you mean?
Yeah.
Ah. Yes, that's fluctuating.
It's not about the tells me it's vorticity map, but it's pretty easy to see from the picture.
That's an the nematic director is a defect there, yes. Okay. So you would like
so
to get an idea
so
to defect-defect interactions. We haven't done that, but that's a good idea.
No one has any idea how to do defect interactions.
Well, there's been a lot of studies about this for anti-pneumatic, where you actually get defect-mediated turbulence, sort of like you get a shear polypneumatic.
Then you get
these combinations generated, they interface between vortex, anti-vortex, or the velocity. And you can actually show that I can tell you about this.
So if you know any papers, since it would help me if you think in terms of topological defects.
There's a lot of things that are really puzzling about this result. I mean, in particular, you know, the fact that you get it even from a numerical solution of the noise-free PDE is really puzzling. I mean, I would have thought, you know, if you have an equation like that, we have a long wavelength instability and short wavelength stabilizing term. I would have guessed that you'd get some sort of periodic state, which obviously you don't get.
No.
Mm-hmm. Given that you don't get a periodic state, the sort of only...
You mean a lattice of swirls or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah. Or a lattice of some kind. You know.
We never got that. So this
it's
very hard.
I don't know exactly what structure you'd anticipate, but whatever structure you'd anticipate, you'd be wrong, because that's not what you get. And then the other question is, okay, so if it's something that's disordered, you could ask what would be the appropriate long wavelength description of that. In other words, you know, there's a characteristic length scale,
mm-hmm.
characteristic wavelength in this spectrum. So
yes.
Suppose I looked at length scales long compared to the inverse of that characteristic wavelength. Okay. There should be some continuum description of that. Now, presumably that continuum description would be something that would not have a negative. Would not
I agree,
have
yes.
instability.
Yes.
Because on a large scale, this is
yes.
homogeneous.
Yes.
So what would you write down? The only thing I can think of that you would write down would be the Tone of Two equations with a positive diffusion constant.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't give you a k to the 5/3. That would just give you a mm-hmm. spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very, very puzzling, even at the level of the deterministic PDE. That That's just a comment. I'm deeply, deeply confused by this result. I mean, it's, you know, you can't deny it. It's true that you do the simulations as good you get, but it's very, very, very
difficult. So, just to understand better the results, so the power spectra are coincident with in all three cases, meaning the experiment, the simulations.
These are the three cases.
I see all three.
Yeah. Okay.
So they're overlapping each other essentially. Okay. And the other one is that the other question is that scale that John was talking about, what is it? That peak scale, that's characteristic scale?
The third size?
Yeah. That's
how big is it compared to the
50 sizes of the individual particles.
Which is not this big.
I have no idea why.
And the last question is this will be like fully developed turbulence, like in the pathway towards turbulence, can that be compared to experiments and simulations? You know, the developing turbulence state? Like, because the spectra sometimes, you know, evolves in a specific way.
As a function of time. You know?
Yeah, as a function of time, and then
that. You haven't checked that.
You mean the spectrum in ordinary turbulence?
Yeah.
We just waited long time and hoped that there is no systematic drift.
If you had looked at that at all.
That would be a nice idea in the next.
Could be additional kind of clues to what difference.
You could do it in the sim.
Oh.
Yeah, you. You could do it in the simulation, yeah, and check that, but yeah, it would be fascinating. So the question is now, okay, let me summarize. This is not the end of the talk, hopefully. So there is a mesoscale turbulence in living or active fluids. We call it bacterial turbulence. It's happened for bacteria. It's different from the normal turbulence, and it needs more exploration. Is it universal? Do you see it in other systems? And is the scaling really a scaling or just a crossover? But it doesn't follow Kolmogorov-Kreisner scaling. So then the question is what to do next? This is exactly your point. There are many things you can do. But we were inspired by the conference organizers on carriers. And for example, in this paper, it was explored for catalytically driven particles. What can we do with this turbulent phase? Can we, say, exploit it somehow? Yeah? And the idea that also came with Igor Aronson is, yes, maybe put a carrier now into the bath. Now you have a bath of bacteria, they are making this swirling, and you throw in a little carrier. And the carrier, and this we know from other work at low densities, is this wedge-like particle. So it's a V particle or micro wedge. And Igor has done real experiments, and we met by accident on a conference which was organized by Holger in Potsdam, and then said, well, I have data, and this was developing to a very fruitful collaboration, and here are the results. So they prepared these particles now. They are just passive particles, but they are exposed to an active bath in the micrometer range, several hundreds of micrometers is the domain, and then you can. Bulldozers is also a V if you put away the snow.
Also this V shape.
And that's the reason why we call it bulldozer. Yeah. So here's an experimental movie. So I should say that they can control also the orientation of the
cloud.
Of the V by an external magnetic field, and they fix it. So the orientation is fixed, and they can also, by switching the magnetic field inverse almost instantaneously, the orientation. But the translation is not, say, fixed, so this guy can move in this direction, also in this direction, but will not rotate.
This is
what you get if you go into the turbulent phase. So this is again Bacillus subtilis. Turbulent phase, state conditions, and you throw in this particle, so this carrier. What you see, it gets directed motion. But sometimes it's back. Now they inverted the field, and then it goes upwards. And here is whatever boundary, so it is, or field of view is finished, I don't know.
And now you can do
the same self-propelled rod model. the cleansing did, and model this carrier here with appropriate sizes, and also go to the state conditions of turbulent phase, put it in here, and to confuse her, I've now turned the wedge, so it will now hopefully go to the left.
And it does.
It doesn't want first, but then it goes, and there are fluctuations, but on average, it goes left. These are periodic boundary conditions of the simulation. And look at the swirls, they're almost everywhere. But the important point is, it's a very simple point, it took me many months to realize it. The important point is the swirls are almost everywhere, but they are not here, since you are in the edge. So this V-shapes is, rectified in this direction. This rectification also occurs for lower concentrations, and this was shown by Leonardo, for example. So you have this thing. But if you compare it, you see that the this is the carrier speed, or the bulldozer speed. That's a function of concentration of the bacterial bars. Simulation is left, experiment is right. So in the low density case, where only a couple of particles are getting, stuck into this cusp, they are pushing this bulldozer to the left, so there is a velocity. But if you then increase the density, the turbulent state is the state which maximizes the propagation velocity of the carrier. And then if you go to higher densities, the jammed phase comes, and if it's jammed, it goes down again. So you can increase the carrier speed by going to the turbulent phase, and the same is seen in the experiments. This bacterial concentration goes up and down. And in the turbulent phase, there is a maximum. So the turbulence maximizes transport efficiency. And this I like from the perspective that turbulence is very disordered. So you just have disorder everywhere. So you suck out energy, you extract useful mechanical energy since it's directed motion out of a turbulent bath. So that's the basic idea here.
So I have a question. Velocity should somehow go to zero in situation.
Yes. Zero. This is not the real zero density limit. There are some problems with the conversions here. It is linear, it's not shown. It's linear, but then has to be zero here, it's then it's piling up and then going to this curve. With a statistical error, we don't know exactly. But you're right, it should go, strictly speaking, to zero.
So the wedge
undergo
diffusive motion on
larger
scales.
But directed diffusive motion. Yeah. Yes.
They're holding their wedge in a fixed orientation.
But you're not holding it fixed here,
are you? Yeah, in the simulation, we always hold it fixed in orientation, just to match the experimental condition. If you release this constraint, then it's diffusive, since this goes everywhere.
But presumably diffusive in the same sort of way that the original single particle we talked about, where it must maintain its orientation for a while.
Yes. So there's some kind of persistence length in the motion.
Does this change of view, the wedge is smaller than that typical lens scale, the turbulence?
Oh, we have, this is a smaller wedge. So you are like a sort of question asker, since you ask exactly the questions. But this wedge is smaller, but it's not much smaller than the size of the particle. If it's smaller than the size of the particle, the effect is gone. Yeah? When you get random kicks.
But you still, your point is you still get this rectification if the wedge is smaller than the characteristic length that comes out of the
That's my next point, exactly. Now, understanding why is this maximal? So it took us a long time to understand it, since the question is like a bulldozer is doing. There are some reasons for motion, and there are some effects which this reason does. Plugging away the snow is an effect if you move, but it doesn't cause the move. Yeah? So if you watch the simulation data now, for example, for the density, you get this for small density, for small bacterial concentration and higher bacterial concentration. So you get some particles here that are the inner particles which are captured in the kink, and they are responsible for propagation. But there are the dangerous, the obstacles that are other particles opposing the motion, and they are outside and they are drifting away. And this effect is, magnified for even higher concentration, you get a, let's call it hotspot of particles. And these hotspot of particles, they are oriented, and they are oriented on average in this direction. So you just say collecting into this cusp, this hots, yeah? And then on average they are polar, and then they transfer, say, force onto this object and put it into motion. And here is the entropy. So here is the local vorticity. And in the bulk, yeah, that would be as shown previously. This, you know, we show just the square of it here, the entropy. So not the curl, but the curl squared. So white means no swirling. Black means a swirl. So you see here is a swirl here. That is also an effect. So if you put a wedge through, say, quiescent fluid, it will make these swirls here. But more importantly, in the middle of this, there is no swirling. So there is a region in the inside which is protected from swirls. And I think that is a very important effect which one has to take into account on top of this hot spot. So we have the hot spot of particles inside, and we have the absence of turbulence inside the wedge.
Can I ask about the middle column there? Hmm? The middle column where you show orientation. Is the orientation...
This means in the negative x-axis, so to the left.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And wedge means to the right. So it's the cosine of the averaged orientation angle. Yes. With respect to their individual propagation. So. It's just the trend which is magnified. Here's 0.2 and here's 0.7. So it's not a dramatic difference, but it's this a difference.
What is the origin of that previous plot? Is that the velocity of the previous plot? Is that the velocity relative to the velocity of the swimmer?
This?
Yes.
It's the velocity of the wedge relative to the velocity of the individual swimmer. Yes. It cannot be larger than one.
Yes. No, I'm just curious about that.
So now I come to this, let's call it swirl depletion effect, and say if you have a swirl with a typical radius r, it's the swirl radius which we know exists in the bulk state, and you like to enter this wedge, and suppose there are some boundary conditions, no motion here, you get this shielded area where the rods are not affected by the turbulence, and which means they are a little bit affected in the boundaries, but once they are stuck here, they are stuck there forever, and they provide an efficient way to propagate the particle. And this is more efficient in the turbulent phase than in the non-turbulent phase, since you also increase the density. So we have a shielded area. The swirls cannot reach the cusp. And this is what we think makes this propagation very efficient. And this is a cleaning machine. And the problem is known. The cleaning machine, that is a swirl. And it's very difficult to clean the corners, since you just cannot get into the corners. That's the underlying reason. Now you can get a bit more information. It's also interesting to study the statistics of the carrier motion. First of all, the displacement, the change in direction. Of course, not change in orientation, but change in direction if it goes upwards and left side. You can define, say, after a typical time, displacement angle theta relative to the original displacement, and then plot the probability distribution of this angle theta. At low densities, it is almost a constant, since it's fluctuating a lot. But at higher densities, so 0.5 is shown here, it's getting in the simulations this peak structure. So on average, it's going to the left as revealed by this peak. But there's also at very high density an interesting effect that this peak splits into two side peaks. And that's also seen in the experiments, although the resolution or the effect itself is a little bit damped.
It's experimental data.
So at low concentration, it's almost random. Intermediate concentration is directed along the x-axis. At high concentration, there is a double peak. And a double peak means we have high probability because this angle or this angle, it's a zigzag motion. And this is exactly what is also confirmed in the simulations and in the experiment. Now, what is the reason for the zigzag motion? And you have seen it in the movie. It was not always straight, but it's rather tilted. That is that these unaffected rods, which are in the middle of the wedge here, it's a cusp, they fluctuate, but they fluctuate as bundles. They don't fluctuate individually. They are packed, and they only collectively flip. And this gives you certain possible orientations. And if you map that out, what, for example, here, in which direction the wedge should go if this orientation would be in this direction, it is exactly coincident with this peak here. So this and this gives these two peaks.
You mean the positions of those are determined by the opening angle of the
wedge? Exactly.
Yes. Did you test that by putting in wedges with different opening
angles? Yes, we have also tested that with different opening angles. Here's, say, just the orientation of the inner particles shown, which confirms this. So this is the orientation of the particles, this is the motion of the wedge, and it is consistent. But we have done also different wedge angles.
And it follows, it tracks the wedge.
Yes, it shifts these peaks into different ways.
Is there an opening angle into maximizing the velocity?
Yes. It's 90 degrees, that's the reason why we took it. A little bit more. Don't ask me why, but. 180 degrees, so it's not very efficient. Since you need a cusp to guess the particles.
Yeah,
to
180
get.
Degrees doesn't move.
That doesn't move at all.
Well, what happens if you use a curved circular section instead of a sharp angle wedge?
Oh, we did that too. I mean, what we did.
I think that then you would lose the shattering effect.
C particle. That's
yeah. Right.
And there's no motion at all. I mean, you have clusters of particles. They go inside, but they also go outside. So you lose this propagation.
What if you don't make it such a big C?
Ah, you mean this?
I more much.
Again, it depends on this radius depends with the rod size. If this is smaller than the rod size, it doesn't matter.
I was thinking more something like that.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
You know, this is a perfect circular arc, but it just ends somewhere. And say maybe make this angle 90 degrees, so it's as close to your optimal thing.
There's no
now,
motion.
Now, this in your cartoon, there'd be no shielding here, and there wouldn't be any motion.
There's no motion.
Absolutely no motion.
I mean, we haven't done this, but
we have. maybe a little remnant motion. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, on symmetry grounds, you would expect that the motion to anything is asymmetrical.
No, but you can also get
this thing
a motion.
Right. Sure.
So it's yeah. There's no reason to go to the left.
Higher reason is to go one way or the other, but it seems like it would take fine tuning to get the motion down.
Since here you attract more clusters, and then these clusters, so it's
a tricky thing.
Depends on the details of the shape.
Right. I'm just saying that in general, when you have something that's tricky, the chance that the final answer winds up being zero is zero. Now, zero is a set of maybe zero.
If you have a symmetry argument, then you want zero. Yeah. So how I'm doing in time? It's 1 hour, so I maybe come to an end. Or what do the chairs suggest? Yeah. Okay, maybe crystallization, since this is maybe interesting for some of you. So this is the region in the phase diagram where aspect ratio is 1, and the density is very high. And then you get crystallization on the lattice if there is no drive. For crystallization, you need noise. So we have now rotational noise and translational noise. We have a Yukawa model, and then that is in this paper. It's a very simple model of spheres. There is no alignment in the model, no aligning interaction. These are just spheres, but they are moving in one direction with this bounding model. And then you really observe a freezing into a lattice, even if the system is self-propelled. So this is the most important graph. Here's self-propulsion velocity, more or less. Here we are in equilibrium, and we recover the equilibrium liquid-solid transition at these values of the coupling parameter, which measures interaction over temperature somehow. But if you go into non-equilibrium, you also observe a freezing transition, but it shifts to higher coupling. That is very much understandable, since just as a trend, self-propulsion means more fluctuations. More fluctuations mean some kind as higher temperature. It's not exactly true, but as if there would be more temperature.
Sorry, but in fact, there's a sense in which the opposite is true. If you look at a self-propelled ordered fluid, it actually has smaller fluctuations than a 2D self-propelled fluid can develop long-range orientational waters.
It's more coherent in
the
sense.
A 2D system of pointers that try to orient,
that don't move, cannot. But in a neighbor cage of particles, if you have on top of the thermal noise, the self-propulsion, it increases the noise. It's also rotating, so and that's what is found here. So you get a shift towards higher couplings. I think this can be understood. But also the diagnostic, coexistence regions is blowing up as a function of this F. And also, it depends on the kind of diagnostics you take. Normally, there are different freezing criteria. One idea is a structural one. You measure the Psi 6 order, structural order, the Higgs-Hettig order. And if this jumps from zero to non-zero, you say this is freezing. You could also check the dynamics by saying a crystal means nothing is moving. In a liquid, we have diffusion constant, a long-time diffusion constant that is small but finite. In the solid, it's very, very small. And then you define your line with this criterion. And the two criteria do not coincide under non-equilibrium. So it depends on your criterion. And moreover, in the coexistence region, there are wild fluctuations. So there are crystallization processes. Here we are now in the coexistence regions. We call it bubbles. So this is something which is not known from equilibrium systems. So this comes from the self-propulsion. Then we have with Andreas Menzel also thought about a theoretical description of these active crystals. So what are the minimal ingredients? And we derived some kind of model, also relying on your work, Christina. And we found two states. So this is one of the results, I just sketches. This is, say, the standard crystal, which was also in this work by Julian Bialke and Thomas Speck. So that is something where the orientations of the particles are disordered. The positions are on a lattice, but the orientations are disordered. They just try to get somewhere in the cage, but there is orientational diffusion. So it is a homogeneous phase in terms of the orientations. Well, here it is polar for the orientation, and this is crystalline lattice, but the particles, if there is alignment, this is clear, a line, and this alignment can get macroscopic, and then the alignment is self-propulsion. This implies that the whole crystal is moving. So the whole block of crystal is moving in one direction, and this is a traveling crystal. This is a resting crystal, and this is a traveling crystal. I mean, blocks of crystals can also move here. But if the blocks are getting larger and larger, the systematic drift is smaller and smaller. But here, it doesn't depend on the size. It just goes in one direction. And here are now some, I think it's the first kind of theory for active crystallization. What you do is you start from the simplest theory, from the simplest microscopic theory for equilibrium crystallization. And that is a phase field crystal model that works with the simplest idea, just one order parameter. This is a scalar density. And you put into your free energy a fourth order gradient term, similar as for the microemulsions in the early days. So you get solutions which are undulating. Yeah? And they bear a characteristic lattice constant. So this is in equilibrium our crystal. It's some kind of density undulation. In two dimensions, it's then on a triangular lattice or on a striped lattice. And just known from the pattern formation people, also known from Gerhard's microemulsion work, but it was discovered in the context of crystallization later in 2002 by Ken Elder and co-workers, and it's called phase field crystal model. Since it's a normal phase field model, but there's an additional gradient on top of that.
Got the reciprocal lattice vectors of.
I mean, this length scale are true. They give you the lattice vector, so it's set to be unity. It is rescaled.
Hexagonal crystals.
Or? Hexagonal crystals or stripe phases, which are not crystals. They're just. Yeah, smectis or lamella or in two dimensions, it doesn't matter. And then we couple this to an orientational, that is a reduced zone 2 model, to an orientational dynamics, which is driven by this free energy term that has just global polarization or not polarization. And then here are two couplings between the two models. These couplings are guessed by symmetry considerations, and it's the lowest order terms. But they're also intuitive since you advect the polarization field here with this V naught, and here you couple into the gradient. It needs to be a vector. So a vector of psi 1 is the first non-trivial construction you can do if you have a scalar. So it's this gradient. And then you put everything in your cookpot.
One minus
gradient square.
No, it's
one plus. The square should be. It is minus. The square is minus k squared.
Yeah. That's why, because you have already done the partial integral.
Yeah.
In Fourier space, it's minus.
In Fourier, yes. And so here are some states. What is shown here are density contour plots of the stationary state. The red color is the density order parameter psi 1, and the blue arrows are the orientation in 2D. And so this is the crystal that we get. The solution doesn't depend on the initial conditions. It's the resting crystal in the sense.
Sorry, these are obtained by looking for static solutions, numerically looking for.
Numerically for getting into the static, into the steady state, yes.
So meaning. You said all the time your return to equal zero and solve it.
Exactly. Yes.
So how do you get this
into the that's a very serious point. So you get it in this mean field like series, you get it. In reality, you don't get it since you have this Mermin-Wagner theorem.
Well, except you don't know the Mermin-Wagner theorem applies that equilibrium. You don't know that the Mermin-Wagner theorem applies that equilibrium. In fact, you know in homogeneous smoothing state, it's not.
But it would be, it only applies in equilibrium.
Well, it applies in equilibrium for the reasons you know, but it does not apply in equilibrium. In fact, for a moving fluid state, a state with a spatially homogeneous density and non-zero average velocity, the Mermin-Wagner theorem doesn't apply. That's
why
that
still goes to question.
I think Siegfried is right that there will be no long-range positional order even for driven crystals. There is no argument for it. And I don't know the proof, but I would expect it since it's a very general argument. But even if this is okay, what would be an interesting question is the hexatic phase, yeah? Mm-hmm. Which you don't get with this density function theory. But which you get in reality and how this is affected, I don't know. So this is more a rough sketch of trends, not a real full microscopic thing. No? But you see that you get then spontaneously, so to speak, a traveling crystal. This is a hexagonal traveling crystal. It can change the structure to rhombic, even quadratic. And then there is also this lamella phase, which is traveling. So you get these structures
it's
into.
It's a little bit surprising if we get a hexagonal crystal, given that when the thing moves, that creates hexagonal symmetry. You expect that to manifest itself in the crystal structure.
That's right. So they're really very tiny variations.
Okay.
And you can. I don't have a plot for the order parameter. You can see that they are then developing. They get increasing, and then it goes to the phase. What is shown here is the velocity, so of this global stuff. It's zero, so this is a sharp transition, and then it's like a second order bifurcation. It goes to non-zero, and then here it jumps to the lamella phase. And I think that this experiments of Clemens-Bechinger, for example, could in principle be used to check these predictions. What we know, and that was already discussed by Holger, is not equilibrium, but this clustering. Here's an experiment of Clemens-Bechinger, but you see that the clusters which are growing have hexagonal order, not perfect. There are some defects. But if you change the experiments, that you start, say, from an active crystal that checks the structure, that could be a possible experimental verification. I hammer on Clemens to do these experiments, but here's many other things to do. But I think this one could, in principle, check. OK, I'm not touching this in more detail. This is phase separations. It was discussed by Holger yesterday. But our future work, the chairman suggested, is also going into this direction, in particular to derive a microscopic theory for the phase separation. First of all, without hydrodynamic interactions, and then with hydrodynamic interactions. We have some kind of mapping onto an effective Ginzburg-Landau model, which is sad news in the sense that if you work on long scales, it's like the Kahn-Hilliard model. But this only applies for very long scales. On very long scales, everything is the standard. If you go to smaller scales, then you get non-universal behavior. And to check these corrections, I think, is a task for future studies. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I just have one question about the applicability of the models, not to the experiments that you described for bacteria, but for cells or genus particles. And one thing that's missing in the model is the fact that you have a prescribed velocity of the particle, whereas in the reactive case, they're controlled by the self-generated chemical gradients, which are mutually influence the interactions. And so you have all sorts of screening effects that are much more complex in that case.
Yes, for the catalytically driven, that is a serious thing. For the light driven, it's maybe less serious, but still you have wetting layers, and the wetting layers can overlap if you have neighboring particles, and so there is some complicated physics going on, which is affecting the individual propagation. Yeah. So there's a point. Yeah. So there's some kind of many-body things which change the individual propagation. That's not considered in these models. And also one should say, my suspicion is that the substrate is very relevant if you do hydrodynamics. Since the substrate is only, say, half a particle radius apart, away. So there's lubrication and everything. As Holger has shown yesterday, the substrate is important, but here's only one substrate. And we have some data which we cannot explain with a simple model, but I will not talk about that. So, which I think has to do with hydrodynamics. So you cannot explain everything. But the clustering, for example, in general you can. In the details you cannot.
Yeah, that's something.